Hungary says it will uphold its veto of the next EU budget over rule of law provisions linking payments to democratic standards. Russia accuses the U.S. and its European allies of interfering in the internal affairs of Belarus. Greece says it will extend a nationwide lockdown by a week until December 7th as COVID-19 cases continue to surge in that country. This is World News from our Tehran studios with me, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Starting with developments in Europe, the Hungarian government saying it will uphold its veto of the next EU budget and post-corona recovery package. The Hungarian Prime Minister Chief of Staff, Gergely Gulyás, made the announcement criticizing the budget for linking payments to democratic standards. Similarly, Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki also stressed his government's support for the veto. Morawiecki will meet with his Hungarian counterpart later on Thursday to discuss the issue. Both countries turned down a 1.8 trillion euro financial package because the money is conditional on respecting the rule of law. Now, this while the bloc is investigating the two countries for undermining the independence of courts, media, and non-governmental organizations. Elsewhere in Europe, UK Chancellor of the Exchequer Rishi Sunak says that his country is not willing to reach a post-Brexit trade agreement with the EU at any cost. Sunak says it is preferable to get a deal, but that London absolutely won't be stretching for an accord that's not up to its standards. On Thursday, European Commission head Ursula von der Leyen said that the bloc is ready for the possibility of Britain leaving it without a new trade accord. The two sides have been holding negotiations for months, but failed to make a breakthrough. Britain left the EU in January, nearly 4 years after a landmark referendum. A transition period is in place until December the 31st, which serves as a deadline for their talks on future relations. Our correspondent in London, Amina Taylor, says that the UK is talking tough in order to save face, and the fact is that Britain desperately needs a trade deal with the EU more than ever.
Rishi Sunak's statements, that was off the back of a very gloomy spending review that the Chancellor issued yesterday in the House of Commons, where essentially, thanks to COVID and other issues, Britain is now in a £400 billion hole. Right now, in looking at the whole picture for Britain's gloomy economic output, being within the bosom of the European Union might have offset some of those bumpy rides ahead. We do remember that just a couple days ago, the European Union unveiled its €1+ trillion budget, and Britain no longer gets to partake in that, despite having ponied up some €10 billion in terms of its own exit liabilities. And I think it's very easy to talk tough in these negotiations, but right now, I think the real sad state of affairs is Britain needs the European Union's trading money and access more than the European Union needs Britain right now. In order to save face, really, Britain has to be talking tough right now. But let's see, because there are still negotiations ongoing this weekend, and those will go down to the wire with both sides having to save face and to try and make it seem as if they're doing the best for their particular element. But right now, Britain, make no mistake about it, certainly has the losing hand in these negotiations.
I will wait and see what happens. Russia accusing the U.S. and its European allies of interfering in the internal affairs of Belarus, which has been gripped by weeks of election-triggered unrest.
We have noted numerous facts of gross interference by both the United States and those who follow in their wake, meaning some European capitals, in the internal affairs of sovereign states.
Sergei Lavrov was speaking in a joint presser with his Belarusian counterpart in Minsk. Lavrov said that the West is using the so-called color revolutions, including manipulation of public opinion and radicalization in sovereign states. He said that the Belarusian people are able to sort themselves out without any outside prompting and intrusive offers of, quote, unsolicited mediation. Lavrov also met with Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko, whose re-election has prompted weeks of street rallies. Protesters say that a vote held on August 9th was rigged and demand Lukashenko resign. Several European countries have stepped up their coronavirus restrictions, while the continent remains grappling with a surge in infections and deaths. Greece has extended the nationwide lockdown by another week. The country has registered more than 97,000 cases and 1,900 deaths. In the UK, officials have decided to replace nationwide restrictions with a system of regional lockdowns. French authorities say it would be premature to talk about lifting the lockdown restrictions. The health minister has warned a second wave of COVID-19 is not over. Germany has also warned citizens to stick to the restrictive measures until after the new year.
Should the number of infection cases drop dramatically in the coming weeks, and we will evaluate the situation again before Christmas to possibly draw other conclusions, people have a right to expectations, and here we unfortunately have to say we can't promise to soften restrictions for Christmas and New Year's.
Merkel, however, expressed hope that COVID-19 vaccines could become available before Christmas. She stressed that doctors and other medical staff would be the first ones to get vaccinated. Daily coronavirus infections and deaths remain soaring in Europe. Russia has reported 25,500 new infections. That's its highest daily caseload. It's confirmed 2.2 million infections and more than 38,000 deaths. In Ukraine, daily infections hit a record high of 15,300, pushing the total to above 677,000. Some 12,000 people have also died in that country. Time now for the news review section. Stay with us. Hello, welcome to the news review. The United Nations says that Israel's blockade of the Gaza Strip has cost the enclave's economy an estimated $16.7 billion in just over a decade. A UN report says that Gaza's economy between 2007 and 2018 suffered severely due to prolonged closures, severe economic and movement restrictions, and military operations. The coastal enclave has witnessed one of the worst economic performances globally. Gaza has been under an Israeli enforced blockade since 2007. The UN report also called for an end to the blockade so that the people in Gaza can freely trade with the rest of the occupied Palestinian territory in the world. It says that it was shocking to see that almost more than 2 million people have been left in that kind of situation. Now, I got a couple of guests to join me. First, our correspondent, Ash Shannon, will give me an update on the plight of the people of Gaza. And then we'll have Paul Arudi with the Free Palestine Movement joining us out of Berkeley. Good to see you, gentlemen. Ashraf, you live there in Gaza, and you've been through all of this. And I just mentioned a little part of it. This Gaza is called the largest open-air prison on the planet, unfortunately. So let our viewers know a little bit more about what the people in Gaza have been going through all these years under the Israeli blockade.
Well, Bahrouz, nearly 2 million Palestinians live in Gaza. Around 1.3 million of them are Palestinian refugees or children of Palestinian refugees. Over half of the population are under the poverty line. The poverty and unemployment have skyrocketed under the Israeli blockade and also under the multiple wars that Israel has waged on the enclave since 2007. The report by the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, does not come as a surprise when it says about $17 billion with the losses, although some experts say that the numbers are much higher, because UNCTAD report covers the period from 2007 to 2018. Mm-hmm. People in Gaza suffer from for multiple crises, electricity a few hours a day, water pollution is near 100%. There is lack of medicine, hospital supplies, and especially the situation is horrible nowadays under the COVID-19 pandemic, where nearly 18,000 cases have been reported in Gaza, mostly since late August.
Thank you for that. Now, Paul Alarudi, the UN is saying that this is the end of the interim. It's shocking to see that almost 2 million people have been left in that kind of situation. Isn't it more shocking to see that nobody is doing nothing to help the Palestinians in Gaza?
Depends on your point of view. It's hard to say which is more shocking than the other. But yes, the world is under tremendous pressure from the great powers, chiefly the United States, but also its so-called allies or vassals, if you will, in Europe and elsewhere, not to assist the Palestinians in Gaza, and of course. This is dictated by Israel, which has huge influence and so-called friendship with the United States. As Ashraf said, the estimate of the losses is very conservative because this is based on what the economy was producing before 2007. In fact, the Palestinians are extremely resourceful. And if they were given the opportunity to build the economy the way they want, they would have produced a thriving economy with businesses and export and computer products and all these sorts of things. It would have been like Hong Kong or Singapore or others given the chance. So it goes vastly beyond that. This is siege warfare. It's siege warfare that's of the kind that's been around for thousands of years. And this kind of warfare is designed to starve and strangle the people who are there. That's what's going on. Mm-hmm. The Israelis want Gaza to disappear and its people with it.
Yeah, Paul, like you said, this UN report putting this figure at nearly $17 billion, and you said that should be much bigger because this is until 2 years ago and much more losses than there. So who's going to foot the bill?
The Palestinians are perfectly capable of footing the bill themselves, but the world is responsible for repaying what the world has done to Gaza, and especially, of course, Israel. Israel is the chief repressor, along with the United States. There are a lot of reparations that are due to the people of Gaza. But let's face it, the people of Gaza and the Palestinian people in general are capable of resurrecting their own economy if they're given half a chance and not starved and isolated all the time.
Exactly. Okay, thank you very much for your comments. And inside we have Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent, who joined us from Gaza City, and also Paul Larudi with the Free Palestine Movement out of Berkeley. Thank you for staying tuned. The French Interior Minister has ordered several Paris police officers to be suspended after beating a black man for no apparent reason. Gerald Darmanin gave the order after the publication of videos showing the police beating up the music producer and using tear gas against him. The victim said that he had been walking around without a face mask and walked into his studio. However, the police followed him inside and physically attacked him. Paris police force came under fire earlier this week for its violent handling of a protest staged by migrants on Monday. Now, this while President Emmanuel Macron's government is pushing a new bill that bans filming police officers on duty. The bill prompted objection from civil rights groups and journalists who argued that it would allow police brutality to go undiscovered and unpunished. Now, elsewhere in the world, the Ethiopian Prime Minister has ordered the military to launch a final phase of an offensive on the capital of the rebelling Tigray region, Mekelle. Abiy Ahmed issued the order after a failed ultimatum for the Tigray People's Liberation Front to lay down their arms. He said that he's directed his forces to ensure civilian safety, claiming that thousands of TPLF forces have already surrendered. Fighting has raged on for more than 3 weeks between federal forces and TPLF loyalists. They've killed hundreds and displaced thousands. Rights groups have urged both sides to avoid civilian harm. A Turkish court has jailed 337 former pilots and other suspects for life over a 2016 failed coup d'etat against the President Erdogan. Court documents provided by judicial sources before their official release show the defendants handed life sentences for murder, violating the constitutional order, and attempting to assassinate the president. The trial was the most high-profile among dozens of court cases concerning the coup attempt. More than 250 people were killed and 2,000 others injured during the botched coup d'etat. Ankara accuses U.S.-based opposition figure Fethullah Gulen of orchestrating the coup, but he denies the allegation. Since 2016, tens of thousands of people have been detained. Nearly 150,000 public sector employees have been suspended over their alleged links to the opposition leader. China says it has lodged stern representations with the United States after Washington announced the fresh Iran-related sanctions on Chinese and Russian entities.
We firmly oppose unilateral sanctions on long-arm jurisdiction of other countries by the United States. We urge the U.S. to correct its mistakes and withdraw the illegal sanctions.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman also said that his country will firmly safeguard its own legitimate rights and interests. Beijing will continue to work hard to protect the international non-proliferation system. Now, the reaction came a day after Washington announced imposing sanctions on four entities in China and Russia, accusing them of promoting Iran's missile program. Earlier, Iranian UN envoy, addressing a virtual Security Council meeting, warned about the consequences of U.S. unilateral sanctions. In the same session, Russia also called those measures illegal and a threat to international peace and security. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
10 minutes.
Yemen goes through hell every day. Poverty has been exacerbated by drought, famine, disease, embargo, and war. The Saudi-led campaign has opened a Pandora's box for the Yemeni people, including children. There are numerous reports that Yemeni kids as young as 7 are being recruited by the Saudi-led campaign to kill or be killed while fighting against their will and against their homeland.
الحادث اللي حدث مؤلم جدا لجميع السعوديين.
A little child in red identifies himself on a hill, facing his enemy on the other hill. Blood, bombs, bullets, and bodies. These are drawings by former child soldiers recruited by the Saudi-led coalition, which show what's going on inside their minds. It clearly shows they have been robbed of their childhoods, but they're not alone. In 2019, UNICEF reported that there are more than 2,700 cases of children enlisted in combat in Yemen, pointing out that this would be the tip of the iceberg. Exclusive footage from Al Jazeera shows that these children are being recruited to ironically defend the Saudi border, as if billions of dollars worth of purchased arms and military equipment are not enough for that purpose. One of these child soldiers is Ahmad Al-Naghif, from a village near Taiz, who left home when he was 15 years old. He'd been promised to get regular paychecks and a job in the kitchens of Yemeni military units on Saudi soil. We went because we were told we would be working in a kitchen and making 3,000 Saudi riyals, $800. So we believed them and got on the bus.
They know about the people that they are recruiting, people they are promising what seems to be large amounts of money, not delivering those large amounts of money, sometimes tricking them into being, thinking they're going to be workers, kitchen hands, or in some cases, and then being pushed into the front line with weapons. So I'm sure that they know about it, and I think it does reflect the fact that the Saudis have very little respect for people in their own system at the bottom of the heap, so to speak.
Investigative groups have identified a military camp in Al Bura, near the Saudi border, where the child recruits are being trained. The recruitment process is facilitated by human traffickers, and the recruits are given identification cards before crossing into Saudi Arabia and being placed into a military camp.
It's considered a war crime generally, because children, that is to say those under 18, are not considered capable of giving an informed consent to take on the responsibility of joining a military and being under orders to carry out what might be serious criminal activity. Remember that soldiers since the Second World War are regarded to have their own capacity to reject orders which require them to carry out crime. So there is a type of adult conscience and a capacity to on the one hand, take on responsibility, on the other hand, to follow, to disobey orders, which are criminal orders. And so children are not capable of that. They're taken advantage of. And the trickery I mentioned before is something that also children are very susceptible to. So there's less chance of children rejecting those sorts of orders or standing up against resisting what they're being asked to do. So that's why there's this general consensus around the world that children should not be recruited into, particularly going into situations where they are engaged in conflicts that they don't understand.
According to Geneva-based human rights monitoring organization, SAM, many Yemenis are entering the kingdom under the pretext of receiving emergency treatment, only to be sent to the Yemeni-Saudi border to fight for Riyadh. The Saudi-led coalition is recruiting boys from schools, poor urban areas, and detention centers, inducing them to fight with a combination of bribes, indoctrination, and coercion, according to The Times.
I think it's really taking advantage of poor families, both Yemeni families in the border areas and also poor families in the surrounding regions, including from Sudan, taking advantage of recruiting these young people, promising them, tricking them in some cases into sending their young people in to act as very ineffective soldiers in this terrible war. And it's also reflects, I think, a part of the Saudi culture of disrespect for these young people. They don't really care if they live or die.
But the Saudi-led coalition does not recruit only Yemeni children. In late 2018, Riyadh came under fire for recruiting Sudanese children to fight on its behalf in Yemen. Tens of thousands of desperate survivors of the conflict in Darfur, many of them children, are now fighting in Yemen. Most of them belong to the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, a tribal militia previously known as the Janjaweed. These children are reportedly being paid in Saudi riyals, the equivalent of about $480 a month for a 14-year-old novice. They receive an additional $185 to $285 for any month they saw combat. Their payments were deposited directly into the Faisal Islamic Bank of Sudan, partly owned by Saudis. According to The Times, Sudanese soldiers who fought in Yemen said that between 20% and 40% of their units were made up of children.
I think we need to understand what the Saudis represent in the region. That's very important, that the Saudis are there as an arm of the old colonial regime, of the British regime initially and now run by the North Americans, that they are a proxy for effectively a barrier between the British and the Americans being held accountable for their responsibilities for the terrible dirty war and the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen, that really these young people that are being recruited by the Saudis are effectively masking the responsibility of the NATO powers that are sending so many arms and weapons to perpetuate this sort of war. And I don't think we can understand that unless we understand the role of the Saudis and the fact that they are only there to carry out the orders of these big powers from outside trying to manipulate events within the region. So I think that the role of Al-Saud generally, the family, needs to be understood to understand why there are so many appalling acts going on, including the use of child soldiers to perpetuate this dirty war against Yemen.
A dirty game has been at play since the Saudi-led invasion of Yemen. With billions of dollars in their pockets, the Saudi-led gang is still trying to outsource the war. They want to keep the cost of the war at the lowest possible level. So they're using child mercenaries from poor backgrounds in Yemen or Sudan. Those whose lives are cheaper than the ones in Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Bahrain.
Oh, مدينة العرب.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Let It Fall, LA 1982 to 1992, directed by John Ridley. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Suresh Grover, who is the director of the Monitoring Group, which is a leading anti-racist charity here in the UK that promotes civil rights. Now, Let It Fall provides an in-depth look at the racial tensions in Los Angeles in the 10 years leading up to the 92 riots, which erupted after the acquittal of four police officers charged in the brutal beating of Rodney King. The riots caused a lot of destruction in the streets of LA, which resulted in the deaths of more than 50 people, who were mostly black, injured over 2,000, and caused at least $1 billion worth of damages.
The Los Angeles police officially reprimanded Police Chief Darryl Gates.
We were having deaths from the chokehold.
He didn't get along with the community.
In the early 80s, the street gangs started to connect with the drug dealers.
It just got out of control.
Karen Tashima was killed in gang crossfire.
This is something that you always see on the news, and this time it happened to us.
We are determined to take back the streets of Los Angeles.
Operation Hammer was a free ticket to go out there and do overly aggressive police work.
What I witnessed at the scene was 100% LAPD policy.
Soon Jad Du, found guilty of killing a 16-year-old girl, received no jail time.
She got away with murder.
Black and brown people are being beat up, shot, choked to death by police forces all over this country.
We, the jury, find the defendant not guilty.
Not? You just disrespect us like this? Like our lives don't matter?
Not guilty, the verdict for all of them.
We were sort of stunned.
We need to back out of here before we have to use deadly force.
It's like pouring gasoline and striking a match. It's not protest anymore. Now it's a full-blown riot.
I was a part of a movement, a black movement. There's a Florence and Normandy in every city and every state.
It was just one of those days compassion wasn't handed out to other races.
God told me to go save them, save that man's life.
You talked about guerrilla warfare, and it's right here.
18-year-old Edward Song Lee was shot to death.
That doesn't seem real.
I felt like it couldn't be happening to us.
I know the anger, and I know exactly what my people are feeling.
We've lost the city. It's gone.
I want to know why God let this happen.
Unity, empowerment, they're not just cliches. We have to get ourselves together.
Thank you very much for coming on the show. Very much welcome here. And when you watch this documentary, you feel an overwhelming sense of injustice against black people in the US. And another thing that's striking about this documentary is that it's an oral history as told through many different perspectives and angles, through police officers, jurors, and a whole host of others, the victims and families of the victims. And Lee, if I can start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you've sort of identified what makes it unique and what makes it particularly probing is it's an inside story. So the filmmakers, they don't go to pundits and people from the outside. Every single person you hear from was within the story. They're part of the story, whether they're perpetrators or victims or police or, you know, lost loved ones. And keeping to that very tight focus, I think,
really, I mean, it obviously ups the emotional side of the stories because people are talking about their direct personal involvement, but it gives you that unique perspective because we're not trying to hear from, you know, professors and cultural critics outside it. We stay very much within the story, and I think that's a really great move. The other thing that's great is he doesn't identify who's who. So you start hearing from people, you might then find that they were a policeman who was, you know, inflicted some violence, or, you know, an African American who was involved in, you know, hurting a white American. And by doing that and saving the sort of the revelation, you get to just hear who these people are before. Otherwise, you might just immediately identify them as, oh, racist police officer, or, you know, violent African American. And of course, what you're hearing is a more sort of multifaceted side to each of these stories. And I think that's a real strength in the film.
That is indeed a great strength. And you hear their personal stories. And I enjoyed that progression. And you feel a connection to all these characters. And Suresh, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Let It Fall?
I think it's a rich history, almost a forensic examination of a decade before the so-called uprisings. I wouldn't call it a riot. I use the word uprising, and there's a reason for it. And I think it tries to focus on what took place, what incidents took place, which led to the build-up of the riots, which is very important. The context is very, very important. And even in this country, when there are public disturbances taking place, people only look at one trigger moment that started the stuff, rather than the history of relationship between the black communities and the police, for example.
So you're saying this context is absolutely critical.
I mean, you know, the police commissioner's views about baton charges, metal baton charges, choke holes, and he tries to describe black people not suffering as much as the white people in terms of that. It's just sheer racism, in my view. It unmasks the real relationship between the authorities and people who live in the area, who took part in it and who survived in it.
Of course, LA was a very iconic city, it still is, but particularly at that time because of the Olympics, and they even had their first black mayor. So who would know, and underneath the surface, that all this racial tensions was bubbling?
Well, I think what he's trying to point out is that it's unmasked, but actually people who live in it know exactly what's happening, including the police office and the mayor and the police commissioner. So although the story in cinematic terms is being told through different eyes, what is clear is that the bubble and the bubbling and the simmering and of dissent and the relationship souring between different authorities is actually very, very open and pertinent, and people are turning a blind eye to it. For example, you know, the chokehold is being criticized by everyone. It's actually made illegal. So what do the police do? Instead of decreasing their powers, they increase their powers by using a metal baton. And they use both taser and, I mean...
I'll have to pause you there. We'll go into that a bit more detail later on.
One of the many issues that came up during his time as a chief was the chokehold. It was a controversy for a long, long time in the media.
The Los Angeles Police Commission late today officially reprimanded Police Chief Darrell Gates for comments he made last month about black people and a police restraint method.
Chief Gates said, in some blacks, when it is applied, the veins or arteries do not open up as fast as they do in normal people.
That's asinine. That's insanity. That I still to this day can't believe someone said that. And, of course, that raised a firestorm.
There is a direct parallel between the disproportionate killing of black people in this city and the irresponsible remarks of the chief of police.
There was truly shocking comments made by the LAPD police chief at the time, Darrell Gates. And of course, we learn a bit later on in the documentary that he refused to apologize for those comments. And he gave a sort of apology for people being offended, which is hardly an apology. Lee, what was your reactions watching those comments being made?
Well, I mean, they're horrific. And Darrell Gates, I mean, this area and this time in American history and leading up to the riots, there's been a number of films made on this in the last few years. And so this the film goes over, you know, if you're familiar with those films, a lot of familiar ground. So Darrell Gates has been vilified, very rightly so, a lot of the time. What's very interesting about this film is there's a section towards the end where they show that his son himself was addicted to drugs. And it's not letting him off the hook in any shape or form, but it's giving you another side to this person who is very easy otherwise to just demonize as, you know, the big bad guy. And don't get me wrong, his policies and his, you know, his stance is you know, you can't justify in any way. But what's really interesting about the film is it tries to sort of look at people from different angles and maybe give facets of them you didn't know about without excusing it. But you know, you go, okay, well then this guy has some other issues going on at the time. Now again,
that
doesn't excuse it, but
it's
really trying to look at things from a wider angle than you maybe have seen in the past.
And Serge, would you agree with what Lee said just there? What did you make of these comments being made?
Life is complicated. People are very complicated. I've been in riots in Southall in the 70s, and I know people are complicated. But to justify, I'm not saying Lee is justifying it. I don't want to give an air of justification. To me, the comment about the chokehold and not apologizing was sheer racism, and there's no excuse for it. He's a senior police officer. He's a senior police officer who should be held accountable for his comments and his practices and procedures. Mm-hmm. Yes, he's a human being, but we are beyond that in that environment. So when I live in areas like Southall, which is where I come from, which has had riots, I expect police officers to be totally professional. What I don't expect them to do is to blame the victim or the communities that are victimized by police officers because of their racism. And it's happened not just to black people. I did a case of Blair Peach, who was killed by the SPG in 1979. You know what the police said? He had a thin cranium, that's why he died. Mm. And they used a lead gauge baton to kill him in 1979. Mm. In Mark Duggan's case, what did they say? Honest but mistaken belief. So there's a justification that takes place perpetually by the mainstream and politicians. I do not want to excuse that.
Yes.
That doesn't mean, cinematically, people can't look at the complicated picture and come to a resolution. Mm. But our society is divided between people who have power and who don't have power.
That's
really important to look at.
And Lee, I want to ask you, in picking up on your point, do you think Ridley was sympathetic in any way to the riots through this film? Do you get the idea that the police are in fact the problem, that the riots or uprisings didn't happen out of a vacuum, that people just became crazy one day?
No, I mean, the whole 10-year time frame, as Suresh has noted, it gives you the context and it gives you a lot of understanding of why tensions within the communities and between the police and not just the African-American community, the Korean-American community, Japanese-American, mm-hmm. It's a very, diverse picture that this film paints. I think Ridley is very... he's an interesting figure because he's kind of known as a bit of a polemicist. Mm-hmm. Wrote a very controversial piece for a magazine about 10 years ago using the N-word and criticizing his own community, mm-hmm. With 12 Years a Slave, which he wrote
the
screenplay
for.
Yeah, him and the director had a big falling out. And I was surprised, actually, at how much empathy this shows. It's not his usual kind of... mode of speaking, if you like. He's very much into controversy usually and stirring things up, and I felt that this was a much more restrained and trying to be more empathetic to look at it. He doesn't let anybody off the hook. So as I said, you don't identify some of the people speaking, and then you find that actually some of these guys were the guys who dragged the white truck driver out of the van and nearly killed him. Mm-hmm. Similarly with the police, you see some people making some very, reasonable statements, and you find out they're absolutely part of the endemic racism of the LA police force. Mm-hmm. So I was very interested at getting that sort of, empathetic thing. And again, without letting anybody off the hook, and, there is clear racism going on there without any shadow of it.
Well, of course, and it's interesting that so many interpretations can come out of this, and I guess that's a testament to the documentary. And Lee, as we heard in the documentary, one of the police officers in charge at the time told his police officers to avoid that area. Mm. Were they effectively then abandoning their duty to protect and serve?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly no expert on police tactics and what you should and shouldn't do, but there was a very clear, decision taken to pull out, and obviously that creates a vacuum, and that allows a lot more things potentially to go on that maybe would be restricted if there was a police presence there. But I mean, this is just part of the chaos. I mean, what it does, it really gives you a picture of the absolute chaos that happened within those 2 days. I was actually in LA probably a couple of weeks after these events, and I was actually walking around through South Central LA. I'd never been in a sort of supposedly peaceful community that had such an air of foreboding and tension. And so it was still, just absolutely in the air, really, really unnerving. So I can only imagine what it would have been like on the 2 days in question. Again, that's no excuse not to get the police in there, because that effectively is their job, to try and maintain, some sort of, so that things don't just descend into utter chaos.
But
it obviously had a huge impact on the events of those 2 days.
And Suresh, why didn't the police go to the area? Were you surprised by their reaction? Were they intimidated by the riots?
I wasn't surprised at all by the reaction. It's a very common police practice in a public disturbance to leave an area on its own. You know, public disturbances and riots raise a number of issues, and one of them is, why is it that law-abiding citizens living in that area destroy their town?
But they have genuine grievances.
I've been involved, as I said, I've participated in public disturbances. The trigger for me has been racists coming in and the police not stopping them, and then the police arresting us on a continuous basis. And
so the victim instead of the perpetrator
that comes. And when you are there, you realize the danger that exists. You realize the chaos that exists. You realize that you live in the area and you're breaking up a shop and that you're fighting with the police. You actually realize it's very conscious. It's not as if it's unconscious and there's God, nobody's in control. It's frightening. And it's only people who participate in it, who want to create a message, actually win the day. So you create those areas where the police can't enter for a specific period, for a specific reason. And that is to say that if we are not hurt, and if, after all, even according to, you know, the apostle of peace, Martin Luther King, riots are the voices of the unheard, which is actually what they are. Yes, you have sterile areas created by the police. In the same way, you have policing of what you call saturation policing, which they talk about in the earlier period, which is indiscriminate arrests at certain times to create fear in community.
It was Project Hammer, I think they called it in the documentary, Operation Project Hammer.
Yeah, I mean, in this country they call it saturation policing, and we've in BRICS.
So we'll just pause there for now, as John Ridley talking during an ABC radio interview with Amna Nawaz about the prospect of another uprising.
Worry there could be similar kinds of level of riots or uprisings and
absolutely
that, yeah.
You know, look, whether how the scope and scale, how big they are, how pervasive they are, you know, again, you know, Los Angeles is a city, how it was policed, and I mean the psychology of it, just the numbers, the demographics, what the capacities were, that's very, very different. It was very, very singular. So I have no doubt in terms of interactions, in terms of what happens in communities, how we look at each other, you know, that we know. I mean, we just know that there are issues. Whether that results in a large-scale uprising, whether it results in a few individuals spilling out on the streets, whether that is a public demonstration where police and citizenry are going out together to say, look, there's an issue and we got to deal with it, or whether it's just people who feel like they're fed up. You know, how it happens, what the results are, that I can't predict, but I'm absolutely sure that there are stress points, that there are people who feel like they're being marginalized, they're not being listened to somewhere right now, and they are going to want recourse. We need to make sure that that recourse is positive, it's real engagement, because otherwise, you know, when you take away people's voices, when you take away their ability to be heard, they will make themselves heard in any way that they feel is appropriate.
Lee, you were just saying earlier how much of an activist Ridley is. What did you make of his comments there in that radio interview?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important. You know, historically he's done these, you know, he's had these moments where people have been very critical of what he's done. People change. And I think he would probably say that he's not the same filmmaker or maybe even person that he was when he did these other projects. And fair play to him. You know, if we're discussing this particular film, I think it's a really balanced, restrained, empathetic portrait that really tries to get to the, you know, the hub of a wide range of issues. So, you know, I can only kind of agree with everything he's saying. And it's also, I think the other thing is, we hear so much about this one time in LA. I would love to hear similar projects about other cities in the US and also in other countries. It's not just America that has systemic, you know, issues with its police force and racism and stuff. It's happening all over the world. And it would be great if there were, you know, similar projects as detailed and nuanced that covered other areas. I know more about, you know, Rodney King and Natasha Harlins than I do about some of the, you know, the issues that have happened in this country simply because of the proliferation of documentaries and studies about this time. It's all important. But I'd also like to see other areas and other countries covered in a similar way.
That's interesting. Of course, this year marks 25 years since the LA riots. Perhaps this is why all the emergence of these documentaries are coming out. But Suresh, I'd like to ask you, actually, what are some of the differences or similarities between the US and the UK when it comes to institutional police racism and how they treat black people?
Let's look at the similarities. I think the British police has been found to be institutional racism. because of the McPherson inquiry in 99. And there hasn't been enough work done by the police to show that they haven't, they've actually dealt with it properly. You've seen in this country, just like America, although the proportion of killings in America is much, much, much greater. You have something like 16 deaths a day. Mm. You don't have the same frequency, but it's a smaller black population than America. It's the American population has been there longer. I think what you really have in similarity is the lack of accountability of the police force, the manner in which police always, almost get away with murder or police brutality. Nobody's actually held account in a public arena.
Of course, this is why what caused the riots, effectively the straw that broke the camel's back, was that there was videotape evidence of Rodney King's brutal bleeding.
I think what
and the police officers walked free.
They walked free in Rodney King's case as far as the district was concerned. But obviously, as you know, two people were convicted in the federal court, the subsequent trial. And there are important points to make on the judiciary as well in this trial.
The whole criminal justice system.
The differences are that just the black American political process of being there for a long time, of developing resistance, black power politics, is much more deep-seated than in this country. But this country has this glass ceiling which does not see pivotal figures in the black community just as important as the Americans would do in terms of black. For example, people like Hugh Newton in the black power movement, there are equivalents in this country. And just like this film, there's a film called Hard Stop on Totem Riots, which is a fascinating, moving film of the killing of Duggan told through the eyes of his two friends. It's a fascinating film. It could be much better if it was given more finances. Mm-hmm. So there are attempts being made. But I think this country neglects and actually does not acknowledge the skills that black communities have in their communities, young people, women and children.
So there's much work to be done, I suppose. And unfortunately, we're reaching the end of the program now. And Lee, just the final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I think, I've seen quite a number of the recent films that either touch on this specific area or, you know, institutional racism. And I would say it's one of the more thorough and nuanced films. I would also recommend the Made in America film, which again covers similar things. But it really is, when people actually, it's proper journalism and it's also good filmmaking. And when you put those together, you know, you really do allow viewers to get a better understanding. And then hopefully that's what you can build on to sort of, you know, change things in the future.
Mm. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming on to Doc Review. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.